Okay, so we should be live. Thank you once again, Professor Seth Soton, for coming on once again, Captain Hunter's podcast. I really, really appreciate it.
Sure. I'm happy to do it, and thanks for inviting me, although I this is not your fault, but I'm really getting irritated that we need to keep doing this. Like, this is... Well,
no one's more irritated than we are in the Black community.
I'm sure. You know? This is infuriating.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And for all the listeners out there or watchers out there, so what's going to happen is I am going to be posting in Facebook. If you're on Facebook, you can, I guess, post the comments here on Facebook. I'll try to read them. And also, I'm on StreamYard, StreamYard.com, Captain Hunter's podcast, I guess, on StreamYard. So you guys can go over there and post comments as well. So we want to, if you guys got any questions for Professor Stoughton, our resident expert in legal issues, we're just saving for a little bit. Think about them. We're going to go through some stuff, and we're going to get going here. So once again, I want to thank you once again, Professor Seth Stoughton, for coming on. As we just mentioned, we're both kind of irritated with this crazy nonsense that's going on. Let's start off with how and what you thought and you felt when you saw and heard about this George Floyd incident.
Watching that video was appalling. It was disgusting. It was physically disgusting, because the officers there did everything that we've known in policing officers should not do, stuff that we've known they should not do for more than 20 years. Keep someone in a prone position with their hands cuffed behind their back for a prolonged period of time. Put the knee or shin on the back of someone's neck. Not check someone's welfare, not intervene when you see other officers doing something wrong. It was like a checklist of errors. And I don't know whether these officers were grossly incompetent or whether they were just indifferent as to proper police procedure. I can tell you they certainly looked indifferent as to George Floyd's life. So I don't know what exactly their particular problems were, but it was inexcusable, absolutely appalling, and I'm sure you felt the same. There was nothing that they did right there.
Yeah, I actually think you'd be very generous. I mean, it was deliberately wrong in my, but I guess we'll get into this. You know, I couldn't even watch the whole thing. I'm going to be honest with you. After you and I talked about Arbery, you know, to watch another snuff video was just too much for me, and it was really, really horrific. And just to see this guy adjusting his knee, looking down, hand in his pocket, adjusting his knee, making sure that his knee was in his corduroy, in his neck there, was just too much. Too much.
Yeah, he definitely, I forget, I have some notes on the video. I forget what time I saw this, but you definitely see him relatively early on in the video shift his weight forward in a way that's going to put a lot more weight down on someone's neck, on Mr. Floyd's neck, not just somebody's. For what it's worth, I don't think he had his hands in his pockets. This is a minor point. I think he was wearing black gloves and that blended in with his pants, but ultimately it doesn't matter, right? There is a difference. I was emailing with a police trainer about this, who emailed me and said, like, look, we teach officers to be calm, but one of the problems here is that Derek Chauvin, the officer who was kneeling on Mr. Floyd's neck, he didn't just look calm. So how did we go past calm to this level of inappropriate? And I think the problem is there's a line between being calm and professional on the one hand and being apathetic and uncaring on the other hand. And in this case, it did not look like Officer Chauvin was being calm and professional. It looked like he just didn't care. And that's so far from what we want officers to feel, certainly what we want officers to do, that I don't know how anyone can watch this video and even begin to defend the officer's actions, even raise questions about it being defensible.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, it's definitely, yeah, I'm going to struggle with this because I'm going to struggle to find the right words to try to talk about this. Certainly there is no defense, at least in my mind, as to what he did. Cold and calculated comes to my, attention. Let's dig into the legal aspects of it. Obviously, I want to have you on to talk about the legal aspects of it. Murder 3 charge or third degree murder, is that the right charge? What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think it's a plausible charge. I think the higher degrees of murder, you know, every state defines murder differently. In Minnesota, they have 3 degrees of murder, 2 degrees of manslaughter. And the higher degrees of murder would be really difficult to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And remember, when we're talking about criminal prosecution, all it takes is one juror to have one reasonable doubt about the elements of the crime being satisfied, and there's no conviction on that offense. So I think I think third degree murder was a relatively safe charge for the prosecutor. And what I mean by that is I think there's a strong foundation, a strong evidentiary foundation for those charges in a way that the prosecutor would have to ask the jury to infer a lot more with a higher degree of murder. If you want, we can dive into all of them, and I can sort of briefly talk about one and two, murder one and two, or we can just focus on murder in the third and the manslaughters. You tell me what would be interesting.
Yeah, I definitely think that people need to understand that, because people need to understand, people want, you know, the other three officers to get arrested. We'll get into that, obviously.
Yeah.
They definitely want the right charges. And a lot of people want the death penalty and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. They want the highest thing. So let's talk about why, you know, these different degrees. I mean, I know that we don't want to get too technical. We don't want to lose people in the legalese, including me. But let's talk about, you know, the different degrees and if it's the best charge. Now, we started off talking about intent and all that kind of stuff. And as you and I talked, first started about this conversation is the look in this guy's face and his deliberateness of him shifting his weight and all that kind of stuff. Do you think any of that plays into the murder one charge? Could it help to bolster the murder one charge? So that's the intention part. And then obviously talk about the murder one. Well, first, you should probably start off with talking about murder one, two, three, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And
then I can go down. Yeah, I can do that. Sure. I have one general caveat here, which is I think prosecution is important. I think it is a critical aspect of accountability when we have a case like this. But I also think it's important to recognize that conviction isn't the only, and in my view, isn't even the most important aspect of accountability in a situation like this. And that's because when we're talking about a criminal conviction, the prosecution has to prove every element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. Every juror, every single juror in that courtroom has to conclude that there was evidence proving guilt beyond a reasonable doubt as to all of the elements of the offense. All it takes is one. Right. All it takes is one holdout. And sometimes we've seen even egregious killings by police, like the Walter Scott shooting here in South Carolina, end in a hung jury because there's one or a couple of holdout jurors who just can't get past that beyond a reasonable doubt standard on some particular aspect of the evidence. So just because the officer is prosecuted and convicted does not mean that the problem has been solved at the agency, right? Or policing as an industry. And it's also the case that even if the officer is acquitted, that also doesn't mean that there aren't other and very important accountability efforts that we should focus on at the agency or broader across police industry. So that's my sort of general thought. I think it's really, like, people are angry. They want to focus on the criminal conviction. I get that. And I think criminal convictions are an important part of accountability, but we should not make the mistake of focusing all of our efforts on what can be a real roll the dice crapshoot type situation.
Let me kind of jump in there, because you're saying,
yeah, please.
Even if there's no conviction. So let's just say in this case, there's no conviction, but there's a whole bunch of reforms that would come after that, right? Everybody's protesting across the country. All these
states,
police departments do these reforms without conviction. You still think that is there a trade-off with that?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a trade-off with that. That's not ideal, right? Mm-hmm. But what I worry about is people getting so focused on the conviction that regardless of what happens in that criminal courtroom, that they forget to pressure their elected officials at the local level, at the state level, and at the federal level to make the kind of legal changes that we need to prevent stuff like this in the future. And that's not just criminal conviction. If we're focusing and protesting the prosecutor's decision to bring particular charges, or let us hope not, but or an acquittal, but then we lose interest in the rest of those accountability efforts, then regardless of whether there's a conviction or whether there's an acquittal, we're going to see this again, right? Mm-hmm. Criminal convictions are about punishing the individual defendants in this case or in any case. And that's important. But it's also important to think broader, to think more deeply, to focus on the systems, the agencies, training, policy, procedure, supervision, and the legal framework that regulates policing as a whole, because that's how we prevent the next Derek Chauvin from victimizing the next George Floyd. So I don't want to sound like we shouldn't be concerned about prosecution, but we shouldn't only be concerned about prosecution, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. What? Go ahead. I'll let you continue on the path.
No, I go ahead. I was going to jump into murder one there.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Can I share my screen? Is that
should be able to?
Can I try that? Okay. All right. Okay, we're going to try screen sharing. Sorry, hang on. I'm just trying to figure this one out. All right, we're going to share the entire screen, and then we're going to go to that window. Can you see that?
I don't. Yeah, okay. I had the screen here. Yeah, okay.
The Minnesota statutes?
Yes.
All right. I'm going to, and stop me if I get too technical, because one of the perils of being a lawyer and a law professor is I like the sound of my own voice, so I dive in maybe deeper than I should. First thing to note right here, there are multiple ways of being charged with murder in the first degree. Each one of these subdivisions is a different way of that a prosecutor can argue that you satisfied murder in the first degree. Most of them just aren't applicable, right? There was no criminal sexual conduct. There was no burglary or aggravated robbery. So the one to focus on here is A1. And the word to focus on is that right there, right? Premeditation. Premeditation requires planning. It requires deliberation. In other words, not only must the officer had to have the intent to kill Mr. Floyd, he also must have planned his actions to at least some extent. Now, it doesn't require a great deal of time. If the prosecutor could establish that he intended to kill Mr. Floyd, that's this element here, intent to effect the death, and that he planned his knee placement or keeping Mr. Floyd in that prone position for so long to do so, then maybe you can get to murder in the first degree. The problem is those are both really difficult elements to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. First, premeditation, but related the intent to kill, the intent to effect a death. It's very easy for a defense in this case not to prove innocent intent, but to raise at least a reasonable doubt about Officer Chauvin's intentions. It's very easy for them to say, look, he was trying to restrain Mr. Floyd, and was he incompetent? Sure, he was incompetent, but he didn't actually intend to kill him. And even if he did intend to kill him, he wasn't planning on it beforehand. So I'm summarizing. There's a lot more to say about any of these, so I'm trying to keep it as tight as I can. For that reason, although a particularly adventurous prosecutor could potentially charge murder in the first degree, it would probably be an overreach. It would be very difficult to prove. And if the prosecutor is thinking carefully about this, they're going to be worried about potential overreach. That is, at least in my opinion, and the opinion of many legal commentators, that's part of what really hampered the prosecution of the Baltimore police officers in the prosecution relating to Freddie Gray's death. They overcharged and then couldn't make convincing arguments. And the result was a bunch of acquittals and dropped charges. They ended up not charging a bunch of folks. So I think that's probably why I can see the argument that I think you're suggesting, that you could find intent to kill and premeditation there, but proving them beyond a reasonable doubt is really difficult in police cases. I mean, they're so difficult, again, that we could not prove them in the Michael Slager's trial for shooting Walter Scott, and he shot a guy in the back as he was running away, right? Mm-hmm. If that's not enough, then what is?
Do you know what happened in that particular case? I mean, that really, really bothers me as far as Michael Slager getting away with that.
Yeah, you and me both. I did not expect a hung jury in that case. I thought that there was going to be a conviction, a homicide conviction, although I did not know what degree of homicide it was going to be. There was a hung jury on the state charges. The feds came in and they charged criminal civil rights violations. And Michael Slager ended up pleading to the federal civil rights violations. And the state elected to not put him on trial again because he got a fairly long sentence in the federal trial, and the state viewed that as vindicating the state's interest there. I believe he was sentenced to 20 years, but 20 someone... years, yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's first degree. I'm happy to take any questions or talk more about it before we move on.
Yeah, so if anybody out there has any questions, make sure you type them in the chat and we'll get to them. Right now, we're just kind of running down the questions, running down the different degrees. If anyone has a question as to why the state is not going for the top charge, Professor Stoughton is explaining why the state is not going for the top charge. So now he's going to explain to us the second charge of murder in the second degree.
All right. So here is the Minnesota murder in the second degree statute. And we have two types of murder in the second degree, one of which are intentional killings. That's right there. Whoever causes the death of a human being with the intent to kill, but without premeditating. And the other relevant one is some types of unintentional murders, which are down here, right? Obviously, this provision with the drive-by shooting is not applicable. I want to start with the unintentional murders because they're actually the easy ones to get rid of in the first place. To explain why they don't apply. This provision for unintentional murder essentially says that if someone is committing a violent felony with force or violence, and they kill someone unintentionally, that can count as murder. And the first question a lot of people have was, well, isn't crushing the life out of someone a felony, right? Isn't that a violent assault? And the answer is yes, it is itself a violent assault, but there's this rule that says that you can't use a violent assaultive crime as the predicate felony, the underlying felony for this type of murder statute. And the simple reason for that is that if prosecutors could rely on this particular murder statute that's highlighted on the screen, to prove murder, then they wouldn't ever try and prove any other type of murder, right? Instead of trying to go through the difficulty of proving that a defendant intended to kill someone, they could say, well, we don't actually care if he intended to kill someone. He violently assaulted them by stabbing them multiple times, for example. And that did kill someone. So it's going to be murder under this second degree murder statute. That would effectively work as a bypass, an end run that would allow prosecutors to prove murder in the second degree without ever proving intent to kill. And the courts have said, you can't do that. So that's why that doesn't apply. This one doesn't apply because it requires a protective order. That's like a domestic violence injunction. And clearly that didn't apply. We don't have a drive-by shooting. So the only one really to focus on here is the causing the death of a human being with the intent to kill, but without premeditation. So now we're talking about an intentional killing, but no planning in advance. The problem, again, is this intent to kill. And that's, in policing cases, that's just a very, very difficult argument for a prosecutor make to a jury, because it's way too easy sometimes for one juror, which is all it takes to get an acquittal or a hung jury, to conclude that even if the officer was an idiot, he didn't really intend to kill here, right? He thought he was doing the right thing, even if it was obvious that he wasn't. So,
and that goes to the deference that people have for the police, right? They don't refuse to believe that they can be up to no good at most times.
Yes, that's exactly right. And really, there's sort of psychologically, there's a good reason for that, right? The people who believe that really want to believe, they want to see the police as protectors. And it's very difficult to convince yourself that the group of people that you see as your protectors also sometimes intend to kill you. That doesn't jive, right? The fancy academic term for this is cognitive dissonance. You can't really believe both things at the same time. So the way that we avoid that cognitive dissonance is, or the way that a juror might avoid that cognitive dissonance, is just say, well, I don't think he intended to kill in this case, right? I think he was well-intentioned, even if he was ridiculously mistaken.
Right.
So that takes us to murder in the third, and this is where we actually see charges here, right? This is the first, the most severe charge in the prosecutor's complaint. We can ignore this provision entirely. That's about killing someone by giving them drugs, essentially. This is the one that matters. And now we have without intent to the affected death, that is without intent to kill, causing a death by perpetrating an act eminently dangerous to others. That's one point that we need to focus on. The other one is evincing a depraved mind without regard for human life. That's the other aspect that we need to focus on here. So to prove this charge, the prosecutor would not have to prove anything about Derek Chauvin's intent to kill, because that it doesn't matter whether he intended to kill or not. He would have to prove that the actions that Officer Chauvin were engaged in were eminently dangerous to others. Not just slightly dangerous, not some risk, but they were very dangerous. They were highly dangerous to others. And that in doing those actions, Officer Chauvin, Derek Chauvin, exhibited a depraved mind without regard for human life. In legal circles, this is referred to as a callous indifference or a depraved heart murder statute. Minnesota happens to use the phrase depraved mind. Basically, a depraved mind is when you just don't care one way or another. The classic example that I use in my law school classroom is of someone who takes a gun and fires into a crowd. I'm not trying to kill anyone when I do that. I just don't care whether I kill anyone. Well, if you don't care, you are evidencing a depraved mind with no regard for human life. So I think we can start to see how a prosecutor might make this argument, but I have to tell you, I think this is a problem in the prosecutor's complaint, which I don't have pulled up, but I'm sure viewers can find easily online. I didn't see very much in the complaint that can help establish, that lays out the particular facts about this move being eminently dangerous. It does mention that it's dangerous. It does mention that officers are trained not to do it, but it doesn't really provide a lot of detail about why it's eminently dangerous, which it is. I'm not saying it's not. I'm saying that there's a problem with the complaint here. And I don't think there's a tremendous amount of detail in the complaint about a depraved mind. So I hope the prosecutor is thinking very hard about how to best argue both of those elements.
So we got a couple of questions that came in here, and I'm going to take the second one first because we're on talking about the intentionality.
All right.
Miss Zakia McCoy is asking a question. Doesn't the video show intention, right? This is what we talked about at the beginning.
Yeah.
We talked about, you know, his guy's looking down, the calm look in his face and all that. Is that not intention right there?
The video... Yeah, it's a good question. The video, well, the right way to answer this is the video doesn't prove intention. The jurors have to infer intention. When we're talking about intent, we're talking about what someone knows, feels, meant to do at the time. And unfortunately, we don't have magic powers that can allow us to divine and tell with any degree of precision what someone's mental intent was. So what we do instead is we point to their actions and we say, based on their actions, we have to make inferences. Jurors have to make inferences about the intent. And what Ms. McCoy is doing there is exactly that, right? She's looking at the evidence and she's saying, well, based on his actions, I infer that he must have intended to kill here. I don't think that's a crazy inference. I think that you can watch this video and you can draw that inference. What I don't think is easy at all, though, is for a prosecutor to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to jurors that they should or must believe that inference. And I think, particularly given that deference that we were talking about, it's very easy for a juror to say, even a juror to say something like, well, I can see how you might believe that, but I just can't believe that beyond a reasonable doubt. Right, beyond a reasonable doubt is supposed to be a high bar. So is there any reasonable doubt that he might have not intended to kill? That's the question jurors are going to be asking themselves. And it's a tough position for a prosecutor to argue. But it's a good question.
Very good. Chief Verdon Riddick is asking a question. Does the autopsy have a significant impact in a criminal case such as this? And now we've got two autopsies now, right? The second one just came in today. Yeah.
Yeah. So I skipped over something really important, right? I was going to get to it at the end, but we can do it now. The autopsy is critically important. And it's critically important because every one of these homicide statutes has this phrase in it, right? It's only a homicide if the officer, the defendant here, Derek Chauvin, if he caused the death. Here we go. So what does it mean to cause a death? Well, this is a cause and effect relationship. It means that if the officer's actions did not cause the death, if they didn't contribute to the death, that is, if Mr. Floyd would have died anyway, even if the officers had not done what they did, then it's going to be impossible to prove a homicide charge. So to answer Chief Reddick's question, is the autopsy important? Yes, the autopsy is critically important because that's what we use to prove that they caused the death. Now, I'm a little concerned about the complaint and the way it described the preliminary results of the medical examiner's report. We don't have that, or at least I haven't seen yet, the preliminary medical examiner's report, let alone a final report. The only thing I've seen mentioned is the way that the prosecutor's complaint talks about it. And it says that there was no sign of strangulation or traumatic asphyxiation, and that the officer's actions in combination with some other factors. I believe it mentions pre-existing health issues with Mr. Floyd and possible intoxicants or something like that. Right. Yeah, well, we can address that separately. it says that all of these things together caused his death. Well, that's fine. That means officers still contributed to, they were still a cause of his death. In legal training, we refer to this as but-for causation. But for the officer's actions, Mr. Floyd would not have died, even if there were other contributing factors. Now, the independent autopsy, the family's doctor who did the autopsy, he found an even more direct relationship because, at least according to the news reports that I've seen, he's saying that that was asphyxiation. So there we can say not only did officers contribute, they were the primary. In fact, they might have been the exclusive cause of his death. Really, it doesn't matter legally whether they were the primary cause of death or whether they contributed to the death. What matters is, were they a but-for cause, right? If we took their actions out of the picture, would Mr. Floyd still be alive? And if the answer is yes, then they were a cause of his death. But the question is well posed there. And yeah, the autopsy is really important.
Can the defense raise the idea? Well, I think now that the second, the official state autopsy is now reading homicide. If I'm just listening to CNN today, now they're saying that they're listing the causes of death as a homicide, whereas okay. Before it was very weak in what they were writing. But let's just say they conflicted, right? Obviously the defense would pick up on that. One is saying this guy had atherosclerosis, and the other one's saying, yeah, he died of asphyxiation. So that's
hypertension on the one hand, asphyxiation on the other, right? Yeah, absolutely. And remember, the defense's job is not to disprove anything. The burden is on the prosecution. Excuse me. The defense does not have to prove that it was hypertension. They just have to raise a reasonable doubt that it might have been. I have no idea. I don't think hypertension would do that, but I am definitely not a doctor. That is, to go back to just a second, this idea of like whatever I forget the way the report says it, the possible narcotics or possible intoxicants. That bothered me that was included, right? Because for a couple of reasons. First, if you don't know, then why would you put it in there at all, right? If there's no good reason to think that there were intoxicants or narcotics in his system, then why raise the possibility? That would be like saying, he had pre-existing medical conditions and also possibly a meteor hit him in the head. Well, is there some reason to believe that's the case? And if there is, maybe that needs to be explained. The other part of that bothers me, and there's a public health professor who I know is working on an op-ed on exactly this point, that focus that we see in cases, particularly officer-involved homicide cases, on the victim's toxicology. He had marijuana in his system, or he had crack cocaine metabolites in his system, or something like that. It isn't always highly relevant. It can be relevant, but it can also be a not so subtle way to shift the blame onto the drug using bad guy, right? All of a sudden, we the public, or maybe jurors, are going to say, okay, well, now there's a little bit more reasonable doubt here. Not because of anything the officers did or didn't do, but instead because the guy also had cocaine metabolites or opiates in his system or something like that. And I'm just bothered by that. I get it as a rhetorical strategy. If I was the defense attorney, I would be leveraging that too, because it is something that people sort of react to. But I'm bothered by it because it's not... It often does not bear the weight that we put on it. Go for it. No, keep going. This is great.
Ms. McCoy has another question. What is the differences between the sentencing that may be in the statutes that we're reading? The differences between the sentencing between first and third?
That is a great question, and I would have to do some Googling, to pull up the correct statute.
No, okay, so, we don't have time.
you see some of the sentences in the in these statutes, like murder in the third degree, not more than 25 years, murder in the second degree, not more than 40 years. What I don't know is what sentences are standard, regardless of the statutory maximum. And I don't have a good sense of what the mandatory minimums, if any, are, although I know Minnesota has some homicide-related mandatory minimums. I just don't know what they are offhand.
Right.
So what we see in these statutes are maximum sentences, but I don't know what the minimum or what the normal range is.
What's your thoughts on now Keith Ellison taking over from the as a prosecutor, as a chief prosecutor? Right. The prosecutor there, Mike Freeman, was replaced. People had no confidence in him. What's your ideas about that?
Yeah. So I don't know a lot about Mr. Ellison. What I know of and what I've heard from friends are all positive things. So I think we have a competent attorney looking at this, and I think that's very much to the positive. The decision to switch a case from the local prosecutor to the state attorney general, or any outside prosecutor for that matter, is a contentious one. But when it comes to public faith in the prosecutor's decisions, I think it can be really important. People know that the prosecutor, the local prosecutor, works with the local police. I don't mean on like a day-to-day grab breakfast together regularly way, but the prosecutor relies on the police to do most or all of the investigation cases they prosecute. So there is a degree of functional dependence there. And that can raise public doubt about a prosecutor's independence, about a prosecutor's ability. The perception is these are two agencies that work pretty tightly together. They rely pretty heavily on each other. How can we trust that this prosecutor is really going to act in the public interest and not in a biased way to the favor of the officer? I think that appearance, regardless of the mere appearance of that, can shake public confidence. And in a case like this, it is exceptionally important to maintain public confidence. I tend to generally be supportive of outside prosecutors, both because I think their decisions are less likely to be influenced by because I think their decisions appear to the public to be less influenced by bias. And that's a really important point. Should we go down to the manslaughter, or we got more on the murder charges?
I think we're good on the murder charges. Let me ask you, what's your thought process on the difference between this case and the Eric Garner case? We had video in both cases. There's national outrage. I'm understanding now that there's at least a city in all 50 states are blowing up or having some type of protest. Blowing up is probably the wrong word. Some type of protest. All 50 states.
Yeah.
Across the world. What's different about that compared to the Eric Garner case?
When it comes to the underlying cases, I don't know that they're actually that different, right? But I think that's why we see a lot of public reaction right now. Because we, as a country, as a world, didn't we just see this? Didn't we just see Eric Garner saying that he couldn't breathe and then dying as a result of similar, although not identical, actions? I think the fact that this is a repetitive problem is part of what's driving public sentiment here, right? If this was a one-time thing that had never happened before and everyone in the country thought surely the police and the prosecutor are going to respond appropriately here, I don't think we would be seeing the protests in all 50 states. But it's not. It's a repeat issue. It's a repeat issue at this particular agency, right? I can take you back to 2013. I believe this gentleman named David Smith, the city of Minneapolis paid out a $3 million settlement to the family of David Smith after he suffocated to death while being held in the prone position with his hands cuffed behind his back for more than 4 minutes. Sound familiar, right? So I think we see echoes of Eric Garner in this case, and that's infuriating to see the same problem again. I also think that this is a more egregious case than the Eric Garner case. In the Eric Garner case, the officers were, I apologize for the phrasing here because I'm not quite sure how to say what I want to say, but the officers were active. There was a struggle. They were moving around, right? So it at least gave the appearance that that stuff was going on, that Mr. Garner was still resisting in some way. And here you don't have any of that. You have George Floyd laying, even while he's talking, he's laying passively. His movements are minor at best. And he's saying, I can't breathe. And they just stay on him. And even after he begins to lose consciousness, they just stay on him. And even after he passes out, they just stay on him. So I think not only is this an echo of Eric Garner, it's like an even more egregious version of Eric Garner. I think people are reacting to that too.
Once again, if you guys have questions, make sure you shoot them to me. The other three officers, they're going to get arrested. What's your thoughts? What's the correct charge for those guys?
Oh, man, that is... look, there's a difference between would I like them to get charged with something and do I think they're going to get charged for something. So let's establish that. If I was king of Minnesota law, I would have very little trouble saying that they were at least criminally negligent in not doing something. But I'm not king of Minnesota law. So charging the other officers is going to depend on a couple of things, and I don't have all the answers here. The first thing it's going to depend on is whether they were doing anything other than standing by, other than watching, the way that officer, I believe his name is Thau, was. That was the officer who was interacting with the bystanders. We know from another bystander's camera, that little 18-second video clip from sort of behind where the officers were positioned, we know that at least one point, more officers, officers other than Derek Chauvin, were on Mr. Floyd's back. If they stayed there, I think they're susceptible to exactly the same criminal liability that Officer Chauvin is susceptible to. Because just like him, they were physically on Mr. Floyd and part of keeping him in this ultimately lethal position for so long. If they weren't, if they had gotten off Mr. Floyd, and if they, like Officer Thau, were just watching this, that becomes a more difficult question. And it's a more difficult question because typically in American criminal law, not doing something isn't a crime. This is called omissions liability, liability for failing to act. And there are some offenses where we do have omissions liability. If you fail to pay your taxes, you may be criminally liable for not doing something. But the rules that govern omissions liability essentially are that you have to fail to do something that you are under a legal duty to do. And that's a legal duty, not a moral duty, not a professional duty. It has to be a legal duty. And let me give you a horrible example. If I was standing in my backyard looking across my little fence and I watched my neighbor's kid start to drown in their pool, and I just watched, but didn't do anything. Even though I could walk over, I could open the gate, I could walk over there, I could fish the kid out with no problem, no risk to myself. If I just stood there and watched, that's not a crime. It's not a crime because I'm not under a legal duty to save my neighbor's kid. Horrible, but true, right? This is just the nature of American law. There are policy reasons that we can get into for that. This is always one of the more difficult discussions that I have in my criminal law class. So if that's the case, if the officers didn't do anything, the question is, were they under a legal duty to intervene? We know they were under a moral duty. There's no question about that. If you see someone that you work with doing something that egregiously wrong, you have a moral duty to step up. We know they were under an administrative duty. In fact, that's why the other officers were fired, because the Minneapolis Police Department has a policy that requires them to intervene when they see an officer doing something wrong. What I don't know, because I'm not an expert in Minnesota law, what I don't know is whether, as a matter of state law, they had a legal duty to intervene. Because just because they were under an agency policy duty does not establish that they were under a legal duty. So I don't know. I wish I knew more about it. I can't find a good answer in the relatively limited research that I've had time to do so far. There are some other possibilities that people may be considering. Conspiracy liability is one. Accessory liability is another. Conspiracy liability, I can do those very quickly. Conspiracy liability essentially requires them to enter into an agreement with Officer Chauvin, Derek Chauvin. I need to stop calling him Officer Chauvin, because...
Yes, please stop calling him Officer.
Yeah, it hurts my soul to say yes. That. And he has been fired, so he is not right. An officer anymore. Conspiracy liability would require them to have entered into an agreement with Derek Chauvin. The agreement would have to be to commit the underlying crime. That's really tough to establish when there's an unintentional homicide like third-degree murder. It's also difficult to establish an agreement. You don't need to shake hands or have a signed contract or anything like that. The jury can infer that there was an agreement. And I think there may be some facts here that the prosecutor could use, like the fact that at one point an officer, according to the complaint, another officer did say something like, we should get him out of this position. And Chauvin said, no, he's going to stay here. And the officer said, okay, right? But proving that that was an agreement to commit an underlying crime is tough. So conspiracy liability is difficult in a case like this. The other thing is accessory liability. They have to contribute to the commission of the crime in some way. Also difficult in police cases, because the defense is going to make the argument that the officers but the officers were trusting one of their own the way that they had been trained to do. They were following the cue of the guy who had scene command. And that means they weren't actively trying to help with the commission of a crime that's required for accessory liability. They were, to use the counter-espionage phrase, they were useful idiots at best, right? It's really weird for a defense attorney to argue that his own client's an idiot, but it would prevent something like what we're talking about. So it's going to be tough. I think we're going to have to see. It's going to be tough. Now, so far, we've just talked about the big crimes, right? The homicide crimes and the accessory and conspiracy to commit homicide. There's also the possibility of assault crimes. If officers used force when it wasn't authorized by state law, if they exceeded their state law authority to use force, then they were committing assault, right? And the prosecutor could go after that. Obviously, it's a less severe crime, but I think it's one thing that may be on the table here as we see this progress.
Very good. So I just want to remind the audience there, if you got any questions, to fire them away.
I'm going to try and cancel my screen share too. So I think we're done looking at those statutes. Yeah. We can go back to them if you want, but I don't want to get too technical.
Yeah. So, I had a question about, okay, well, let's pretend you're the prosecutor. I want you to play devil's advocate. You're going to be the prosecutor and you're going to be the defense attorney. Just kind of sum up which way.
Well, you should teach it at law school, because this is exactly what I do to my students, right? I make them give me an argument and then I make them tell me why it's wrong.
Right. So tell us how you would proceed and then tell us how to defeat that argument.
Whew, boy, yeah, you're not making it easy on me tonight. Okay, so if I was the prosecutor, the first thing that I would probably start with third degree murder, because of the difficulty of proving intent to kill, and certainly the difficulty proving premeditation. I would, the cause of death, I would rely on that independent autopsy and the effects of keeping someone in this position. No doubt positional asphyxia can contribute not just to death by suffocation, but also to hypoxic problems, low oxygen problems with the heart. I say that sounding like I know what I'm talking about. Again, I am not a doctor, and I welcome corrections from actual informed medical professionals on this point. So cause of death, I think, is squarely on my side. With third-degree murder, the eminently dangerous to human life, I would say, look, we know that keeping someone in this position, face down, handcuffs behind their back, and also weight on them is highly dangerous. We know it because in 1995, the National Institute of Justice released a report saying it's dangerous, it can kill people. And we know because agencies in the mid, late 90s and early 2000s were doing training bulletins and telling officers it's dangerous, it can kill people. We know because even police-oriented media, like Police Magazine, for example, within the last couple of years, have published articles saying, don't keep someone in that position. It's dangerous. It's so dangerous, in fact, that it counts, I would argue, as the prosecutor, as eminently dangerous to human life. Not everyone who's put in that position will die, but that position is dangerous enough that no one should be kept in that position for such a prolonged length of time. So that I would use the body of knowledge. I may even have experts come testify, medical experts, police training experts, about why we do not keep someone in that position. So that establishes that it's eminently dangerous. The depraved mind, I would get trainers from that agency to come in and testify as witnesses. Because again, that 2013 case, one of the components of that settlement was supposed to be that officers at the agency got training on how to avoid positional asphyxia by not having someone stay in that position, that prone handcuff behind their back position, for a prolonged length of time. I would have training records that showed that Derek Chauvin, who was an officer at the agency at the time, had gone through that training. And I would show that video, and I would make the same point that Ms. McCoy made earlier in that question. Can't we look at how not just calm he is, can't we look at how apathetic he is as Mr. Floyd, and I apologize for the graphic nature of what I'm about to describe, as Mr. Floyd gasps out that he can't breathe, as Mr. Floyd says that for the last time, 3 minutes and 10 seconds into that video, as he starts to lose consciousness over the next 40 seconds, as he twitches for the next 20 seconds, and as he remains totally still, I'm sorry, I'm getting a little upset, as he passes out, as he goes entirely limp, and Derek Chauvin stays on his neck and holds him down for an additional, the complaint said 2 minutes and 53 seconds. By my count, it's closer to 4 minutes, but either way, almost 3 minutes at the minimum. Someone who does that, given the training that they had and given the well-known information about how dangerous this is, I would argue as the prosecutor, that's depraved. That shows a callous disregard to the value of human life. So that's the argument I would make.
Before you go on to the defense, Chief Riddick has a question. Yeah,
I'm just so disgusted. I am so sorry. Family show. I'm really disgusted. Sorry. Go ahead, Chief Riddick. I'm sorry. His question.
We're going to stick with you being a prosecutor. What kind of juror are you looking for?
Oh, that's a really good question.
And what factors are going to be involved in your selection?
That's a really good question. And I also have to admit that I have never been a prosecutor. My specialty is in policing and as an academic, and that's my relevant experience. So I'm a little out of my depth answering that question. Jury selection is a really interesting thing. There are there are experts and consultants in jury selection. There are all kinds of strategies and tactics and seminars by prosecutors and by the defense bar about how to get the right jury. There's that, God, what was that movie from like 20 years ago now where the, like Al Pacino is the devil and his son's an attorney and he's really good at picking jurors, which just goes to show the importance of selecting the jury, I suppose. If I'm the prosecutor, I'm going to answer this question, but I'm going to go off on a tangent first. Despite all of the consultants and books and attention on jury selection, including psychologists who study this stuff, we really don't know a whole lot about what we want. One of my favorite stories in my regulation advice seminar is a prosecution for obscenity. This pornography producer, Max Hardcore, was being prosecuted in the Midwest for some pretty gross stuff, actually. And the prosecutor got a jury that was basically chock full of like middle-aged Midwestern women. And the prosecutors were really excited. They were like, yes, these women are going to watch these videos. They're going to be disgusted. And there was an acquittal because it turns out that middle-aged Midwestern women maybe get a little freaky, right? They're not as disgusted by the stuff as prosecutors thought. All of which is to say the assumptions that we have about who makes the best juror in a case like this are stereotypes, right? Let's just be very clear. They're stereotypes.
The Devil's Advocate was that name of that movie you were talking about.
Yes, that was it. That was it. Thank you.
Thank you, Dale.
Weird movie.
I never saw it, so I don't know. I never saw it. I don't watch stuff like that.
it was weird. I can't watch movies like that anymore now that I've gone to law school because I just start finding errors and it's frustrating. It's like watching cop shows, right? Like I have a hard time with that. So I'm like, they don't need to do that. That's not the way it would be. My wife doesn't let me watch those shows with her anymore. Okay, so going by the stereotypes, right? Who do I want on the jury? I mean, probably young black folks or middle-aged black women.
That's what I was thinking. More progressive, probably younger college students who don't like, not that they don't like the police, but are skeptical of the police.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
Or folks who can look at Mr. Floyd and say, that could have been my son. Mm. Or that's the talk that I've had with my son. Right. So that's now, am I going to get that? No, because I can't use my, strikes. I can't do jury selection in a way that's going to essentially get rid of all my white jurors, for example. But if I had, you know, if I was king of the jury pool, probably the young folks, more progressive folks, certainly folks of color. Is folks of color a thing? Can I say, I know people of color, like,
listen, that's I don't know.
That's the casual version. I'm sorry. If that's not appropriate, I apologize.
It changes from week to week. So I don't know. Marlene, you're still the prosecutor, still in the prosecutor role here. Will you be able to bring in, Marlene is asking this question.
Yep.
Will you be able to bring in Chauvin's work history and the past complaints against him? Would that be admissible?
So I would expect the defense to try to file something called a motion in limine, which says that it literally means a motion to limit, to say that that's not relevant and that I can't bring it in. It depends on what exactly those complaints were for, and I would need to do a little more digging. I've seen the news reports, like a lot of us have, that that Derek Chauvin had multiple complaints against him, none of which had resolved in discipline. As the prosecutor, I would want to know what exactly the nature of those complaints were. I would be particularly interested in looking at complaints that would help me prove that he did not care about people, about rules, about life. Because if I can use those to help me establish that he acted with a depraved mind, that he disregarded the value of human life because he just didn't care, then I can potentially help convince the jury that this is just characteristic for him, right? You should conclude that he didn't care in this case because he also didn't care in other cases. Now, there's a big obstacle to that, though. And the big obstacle is going to be the defense is going to say that's prejudicial. The defense is going to say just because he did something wrong in the past is not going to be enough. It not only is not going to be enough to prove that he did the same wrong thing, that he had the same attitude here, but the jury is going to get distracted. The jury is going to focus on the wrong things he did before and not focus on this thing that he did now. So in legal terminology, that's called propensity evidence, and it is typically not admissible. If I'm a clever prosecutor, I'm still looking for a way to help make that argument, though. So it's a good question, Marlene.
Chief Riddick has another question. I got to read this like I'm a like I'm a lawyer myself here, I guess. It's like I think he's teaching a class or something. It is said in law enforcement.
Why, he should be in here talking.
It is said in law enforcement a culture trumps policy. What advice can you give a police executive who wants to change police culture? And I wanted to say that for the last, what are we going to do? But let's fire away here. How do we change these cultures?
Great question. Yeah. So culture eats policy, culture eats training, culture eats reform efforts. You can have the point here, and it is such a good one. And thank you, Chief Riddick, for bringing it up. The point is that you can have the best policy in the country. You can have the best training in the country. If the culture among officers is the hell with what's on the books and what we learn in the classroom, we're going to do it our way on the street, then that policy and training isn't going to help you. It's nothing more than a paper tiger. So it is 100% true. Culture has to be the driver of behavioral change. Policy and training are huge. Don't get me wrong. They're useful. They're essential. But if you don't have that culture, then you got nothing. I want to dive a little bit deeper into that. Why does culture matter so much? Well, I'm going to give you the academic answer here. It matters because of something that social psychologists call normative conformity. We behave the way that we think people around us in that situation expect us to behave, right? Like, there's a reason that I'm not sitting like this talking to my bookcase. Why am I looking at my camera? Well, it just makes sense. What does that mean? It just makes sense. It's what you expect. It's what the viewers expect. So I do it because it's what I'm expected to do, even if sitting sideways may be mildly more comfortable for me, right? When I do presentations on this, I stand on top of tables and do really embarrassing things. But the point is, we behave the way we think that people around us expect us to behave. Culture is what shapes those expectations. If we think that our fellow officers, the folks that we trust and respect the most, want us, expect us to use a little street justice, to get a couple of licks in when we arrest somebody just to teach them who's boss, that's what we'll do. And if we think, on the other hand, that the folks who are around us, the folks we respect most, our fellow officers, if we think that they would be horrified at the idea of street justice, then we're not going to do it, right? The quote that I've seen, the numbers may be off a little bit, but the quote that I've seen is 10% of people will always do the right thing no matter what. 10% of people will always do the wrong thing no matter what. But that 80% in the middle, that's whose behavior is going to get shaped by agency culture. Okay, the second part of that question was, what do we do about it? How do we change culture? And I have a couple of parts of this answer. The first part is, it takes time. Cultural change is slow. It is the slow, steady effort. This is the tortoise and the hare, right? It is the slow, steady effort that's going to win that race, not the rush to change. sometimes it's literally a matter of generation, right? It is generational. One of my favorite stories from a criminologist friend that I work with a lot, one of my co-authors on the Evaluating Police Uses of Force book, talks about pursuits. He's one of the country's leading experts in pursuits, vehicle pursuits. He said, when agencies transition from a very permissive pursuit policy that allows officers to engage in vehicle pursuits for whatever reason they want, when they switch from a permissive policy to a restrictive policy that doesn't allow pursuits, the old folks, the older officers, they weren't doing pursuits anyway, so they don't care. The brand new officers have no trouble with the new policy because that's, as far as they know, that's normal, right? It's those folks in the middle who are used to the old way of doing things. They're the ones who violate that new restrictive pursuit policy, at least until they age out by becoming the older officers who don't get involved in stuff like that. Sometimes cultural change just literally requires teaching the new folks and letting the old folks eventually age out. The other big part of cultural change is it is both top down and down up. Cultural change has to start at the top. That's very obvious. You need the police chief, the entire command staff, the sheriff. They set the tone. If they are tolerant and protective of misconduct, then you're going to get an agency with more misconduct. If they say, we expect you officers to behave yourselves professionally, and while we're willing to address good faith mistakes, there is a limit to that. Right. If they set a firm expectation for good behavior, then eventually that's what they're going to get. So it starts at the top. But and this is the part that often gets missed. It absolutely requires the buy-in, not just of rank and file officers, of your first line supervisors. No one is more important to police reform efforts than sergeants. And not every agency uses the same terminology. So I may be talking about sergeants at one agency and corporals at another and lieutenants at a third. But I mean those first line supervisors, the guys who are men and women who are supervising the uniformed officers on the street, or maybe one level up from that. They're the ones who have to identify policy violations and training violations. They're the ones who decide in the first instance how to respond to those policy or training violations. If you don't have them thoroughly convinced that it is important to identify those training and policy violations, they don't bother. If you don't have a good system for them to hold officers accountable for those violations, they won't bother. If they have too many officers to supervise, they don't have time and they won't bother. So it starts at the top, but you have to get your buy-in. And even when you get your buy-in, it may just be a matter of years. It may just require you to age folks out of certain positions until you can change that culture. And to put this into perspective, the culture of American policing as an industry has changed tremendously since the 1840s when modern policing started. We are not in the same place that we were. It has changed since the turn of the century, the 18th into the 1900s, right? It has changed from then. It changed into the civil rights era, and it's changed now from the civil rights era. It is an ongoing, glacially, painfully slow process, but that's the way that we need to think about changing the culture. So think, for any police chief, I would challenge you to think about changing and improving your police culture, not just this year, but in 5 years and 10 years, and do what you need to do now to start that change rolling. That's a very long-winded answer. I'm sorry for that.
Yeah, no, it's good. I wanted to ask you about the mass culture, right? Because we're seeing protests, as I mentioned before, we started around the country, right? So many people have been complaining about the culture of policing, right? From Alton Sterling to Philando Castile to,
yeah,
I forget the brother's name down in Louisiana who was selling CDs and,
yep,
all this stuff, right?
Tamir Rice in Cleveland.
Tamir Rice, yep. Right? Right. And one of the big things about cultural change, Tamir Rice situation was, you know, the guy was a problem. he quits and was going to go to another department or something along those lines.
Yeah, he had been fired from one agency already.
Yeah, yeah. And the same thing that happened with the East Pittsburgh police officer who shot some kid, 17-year-old kid who was running away from him or something along those lines.
Yeah.
So a lot of people have been, you know, wanted to change American police culture. We've been on for an hour, so we'll try to wrap it up here. If anybody has any other questions, fire them away. Otherwise, I'm going to let Professor Stoughton go. But what does it take to, we've talked about slowly. I don't think that a lot of people have seen a problem. And this is where the protests have come in at, where we take it back to Colin Kaepernick. I want to be very careful about this. Much more conservative right-wing people have said, there's no problem here. People stop resisting, stop running away, right? Stop doing all this silly stuff. Talk about that and that whole thing, that this is what many people in minority communities, inner cities have been complaining about, is how law enforcement has been attacking them, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. This is a really good point. And let me just preface by saying, thank God for video cameras now, right? Thank God for cell phone cameras. If we didn't have this bystander cell phone footage, I would bet good money that Derek Chauvin would still be Officer Chauvin. Mm. It is because of this bystander's footage that we have the public response, the public attention, then the police response and the prosecutor's response, right? Let's go back for a second to the civil rights era. Why did enough, or maybe not enough, that's a wrong word. Why did middle class white folks start supporting civil rights? And I'm not saying that all of them did. I'm not even saying most of them did. But why did any of them? It's because they saw stuff on television for the first time. They saw the way that police interacted in minority neighborhoods. They saw the way that police abused and victimized men and women, children who were marching for the right to vote, for the right of basic equal treatment under the law. That's not the experience that they saw in their neighborhoods. I have kind of an interesting, just personal connection here, right? Because I know this is going to surprise all of your viewers, but I am white.
I thought my screen was just closed.
I grew up in a predominantly minority neighborhood. In fact, the neighborhood that I grew up in South Florida, as it turns out, was the developer who developed it. Had two neighborhoods, and mine was the one where when a home buyer who was Black or Latino would come looking for a home, he would sort of shuttle them towards the neighborhood that my parents ended up buying a home in and moving into. Blatantly illegal, but there it is. I don't think that most white folks, most folks who live in the neighborhood that I live in now, have any conception without this video, without videos like the one in the George Floyd case or the Alton Sterling case or the Eric Garner case. I don't think that they would have any conception, because it's just so far, seeing the police interact with people the way that they did with those, with George Floyd or Alton Sterling or Eric Garner, is so far outside of their experience that it's simply unbelievable. No, they would never do that. I'd know if they did that, and they would never do that, right? So I feel like I'm rambling in the answer. I always feel like I'm rambling. It's because I like to ramble. But I think the difficulty that so many people have, one, they just don't see the police doing that, at least not until they actually do. The second reason is, racism, You know, and I don't just mean, I know we've talked about racism before. I don't just mean the, like, I hate X racism. I also mean the who do I identify with, right? We're very tribal creatures. That's like baked into our evolutionary DNA. And again, I'm talking outside of my area of expertise. You should have a evolutionary psychologist come talk. But we're very tribal creatures. We all gather into us's and them's. We always bemoan the us versus them culture in policing, but every aspect of human society to some extent or another has an us versus them. It's not great. It's particularly destructive sometimes, like in the policing context, but it's kind of inevitable to some extent. Even when folks see videos like we're seeing of the way that officers are interacting with some of the protesters right now in different parts of the country, it's easy to dismiss those actions when the people who are affected by those actions don't look like us, when they look like them, right? So it's very easy to say, yeah, the police acted appropriately with Eric Garner and the police acted appropriately with Alton Sterling. If I, as a person, cannot put myself, if I can't imagine myself in Eric Garner's position or in Alton Sterling's position, and part of the reason that I may not be able to imagine myself in that position is because I'm white and they're not. It's because my circumstances just don't allow me to try on their shoes. Which is really unfortunate. Now, people were pissed. What the other one in Minneapolis, Mohammed Noor.
Yeah, I didn't know if I wanted to touch that, but yeah.
Oh, I'll dive into that one. Hell, this is why I get all the big bucks on this show for appearing. Right, my massive appearance fees.
Appearance fees.
For everyone watching, we're laughing because there are no appearances.
There are no appearances.
Nor would I ask for any for something like this. That would be just, people who look like me were awfully pissed when it was an attractive white woman, right? Let alone one with a cute little Australian accent. Why? Because I could identify with that. All of a sudden, I could imagine my wife calling the police, going out to meet the car and getting shot, and that's horrible. But I can't identify with someone selling loose cigarettes in front of a convenience store in New York, because that's just outside of my scope of expertise, right? Or not, it's outside my worldview, right? So I think that's part of it. And that's, you know, that's unfortunate. There's some really, really interesting research on the way that people who tend to be liberal and people who tend to be conservative think, and the way that we sort of draw barriers between things, right? People who tend to be politically liberal are tend not to draw hard barriers. I'm not explaining this very well, but I'll try my best. They tend not to draw hard barriers. So it's much easier, at least we think it's easier, for me to say, oh God, that could be me. Whereas someone who tends to be politically conservative might have a much harder time with that. That's just cognitively, right? Or at least that's what the limited amount of psychological research that I'm aware of suggests. I'm not saying it's a fault thing or it's not a fault thing, but to answer the question about, like, why aren't people who look like me more pissed about stuff like that? We didn't see it. We can't believe it. And when we do see it and we can believe it, we can't identify with it, right? We can't identify with the victims.
Yeah. No, I think that sums it up perfectly. I'm going to let you go. Last question here, unless anybody else has a question. And before to the question that you asked about culture and change, Chief Riddick said, excellent answer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Percentage of chances of this Chauvin getting convicted. What are your thoughts? If he doesn't get convicted, I'm going to say it. This country is going to. It's going to explode
again. Right. I mean, we saw it. Look, we saw it with Rodney King, initial protests and riots, and then the real pain came when he was acquitted in the state law trial, right? To a lesser extent with Walter Scott, less protest, less riots, more protest. Freddie Gray, right? So what do I think that, you know, I'm just stupidly optimistic here. I'm going to give the same answer that I did in the Walter Scott case, although I will also point out that I was wrong in Walter Scott. I think the most likely result is a conviction. I don't know whether it's going to be a conviction for murder in the third degree or whether it's going to be conviction for one of the manslaughters, which we didn't really talk about. But I think if the prosecutor does a credible job, I think the most likely result is conviction for a homicide offense. I think the next most likely result is a hung jury. I don't see the jury agreeing to acquit. I think that's unlikely. And I'm not quite sure how to rank whether I think murder in the third degree is more or less likely than a hung jury. Like, I think at a minimum, some of the manslaughters are more likely than a hung jury. I don't know where murder in the third quite fits in for me yet. Again, that's a very similar answer to what I said in the Walter Scott shooting. I would have bet money that it was going to be a manslaughter conviction, and ultimately it was a hung jury, right? So just goes to show what I know. But I do think there's a real likelihood. Again, I want to remind folks, don't focus all of your efforts and attention on the conviction. It's important. It's crazy important. I totally get that. And I agree with that. But make sure that you are pressuring your local political officials, your elected officials at all levels, your local officials, your state officials, your federal officials, to take the steps that they need to take, that we know they need to take, that we've known in some cases for 90 years. Years that they need to take to create the legal framework that can prevent or reduce the likelihood of something like this happening again. I'm going to have an op-ed coming out in the Atlantic, a very long op-ed coming out in the Atlantic that lays out some of those legal changes that we should be pushing for. But ultimately, socially, I don't view this as a policing failure. I view it as a failure of elected officials to create the systems that we need to keep officers accountable in the right way. And it's also a policing failure.
Yeah, no, thanks. Thanks so much for that. And yeah, I definitely think that, I know I was kind of on you about you know, if this guy gets off, but there's changes, but you know, I don't know, man. I just can't see us surviving this guy really getting off, and I really hope that he doesn't. And I don't want to be pessimistic about that, but you know, this whole thing about not convicting cops is really bothers me. You know, when we do wrong, we have to be held accountable, and it really just bothers me. But
yeah. Hey, I 100% agree. I think that's why we started talking in the first place is, you know, and the one thing that gives me a little bit of hope about this, about the response to this, I have seen more police officers and not just police chiefs, right? I expect statements condemning this stuff from police chiefs because they have a little bit of it's their job to like represent the whole agency and have performative statements condemning officer misconduct and all that crap. I've seen more individual police officers on social media. I haven't interacted with any in person because of everything, but I have seen more statements from rank and file officers condemning this officer's actions. And you and I know it's really tough to get a cop to publicly criticize another cop. So the fact, which is all, go ahead. I bet I know what you're going to say.
Yeah. And that's what's crazy. I mean, I just went back and forth with someone a little while ago saying, oh, you know, this guy's going to get convicted. No doubt about it. Okay. Well, I thought the same thing about Walter Scott. I thought the same thing about what's that guy's name in Cincinnati who was blown off rounds with the guy and shot him in the head. The University of Cincinnati police officer.
Oh God, there have been so f- many.
There's so many that
right. Philando Castile. I thought the Philando Castile officer was going to get hammered.
Now, is this the same district? Is this the same county as Philando Castile?
It's not. I believe it's this. I think it's this. Well, it's the same county as Muhammad Noor, but I think it's the neighboring county from the Philando Castile case. If I have my geography correct.
Okay. Well, anyway, I thought it all the same as well, but who knows? You know, it's just.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, if he's not convicted, I fully agree with you that it is going to be a firestorm. And you know, I'm not an anarchist. I'm not a police abolitionist, right? I think that there is an important role for policing in modern society, but if that's the case, maybe we need the firestorm. And I hate to say that. That's not me. But if we keep seeing stuff like this, if we keep seeing Walter Scott's, if we keep seeing George Floyd's, if we keep seeing, you know, I don't know what it will take to get the folks who have the power to do something, right? I don't know what it'll take to get them to do what they need to do. But I absolutely put a lot of this at the feet, not just of current elected officials, but of the folks who've come before, who may have paid lip service to police reform, but who have failed to follow through. It's just inexcusable.
Yeah. No, I agree. Professor Seth Stoughton, I'm looking forward to getting your book. I haven't gotten it yet. I'm looking forward to a reading.
They're out. Op-ed.
Yeah, they are out. I'm going to get it.
I'm not. That's all right.
And I'm definitely looking forward to reading his op-ed because I think that now people are really ready to listen. By people, I mean these politicians that you're talking about, is that, you know, we can't survive this kind of crazy madness all the time. And I think what's going on in the cities today is really, really going to bring attention to saying, listen, we can't continue to get away with this. And getting away with this is the wrong word or phrase, but it's obvious that there's a problem and there's a bunch of people who are not being heard. And it's, you know, not social media anymore, but you can look through all social media, Facebooks, and there's all these different memes that we tried to sing, we tried to rap, we tried to kneel at football games. You weren't paying attention. So now we're going to burn some stuff down and clog up highways and all this kind of stuff. So hopefully we've gotten some people's attention.
You know, I just want to publicly criticize the Vice President of the United States for a second, if I may.
Just him?
Well, no, that is definitely not the only person I would like to criticize, but this is a very particular criticism. He tweeted or put out a statement recently that said something like supporting and respecting the rights of peaceful protest. And like, let's call BS on that, right? Because he's the guy who walked out of an NFL game when Colin Kaepernick was engaged in a peaceful protest. So you can't rap about it. You can't take a knee. What can you do? Yeah. And the answer for too many people is, oh, of course you can peacefully protest. Just do it in a way where I'm not aware of it when it doesn't inconvenience me. Mm. And that's not what a protest is. A protest is to make yourself heard. So I fully support the protests. I do not, of course, support property destruction or violence, but I fully support the protests. And I hope that the voices are being heard, not just by folks like me who are already inclined to pay attention, but by the folks who need to be paying attention.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. I'm going to let you go now. I feel like back in church here, to keep trying to let you go here and take it out. So thank you.
My fault.
Thank you everyone for tuning in. I really, really appreciate it. We're going to try to do this a little bit more. I'm going to have to give Professor Stoughton a little break here because it's been the third time on. You and Dr. Turner have been the third time on, but thank you so much for coming on. You guys are such knowledgeable and I really, really appreciate it. Thank you everyone to ask questions. Here. And I really, really appreciate it. Hope you guys stay well, be safe, wear your masks, and all that kind of good stuff. Take care of yourselves. Thank you.
Thanks.